Curva Mundial listeners can get 20% off their next order at Football Devotion. For football designs with a difference, head over to footballdevotion.com and use code CURVA for 20% off your order. That's code CURVA. Welcome to Curva Mundial.
Hello, and welcome to the Season 7 premiere of Curva Mundial. I am your host, Sal Bono, and my next guest is the studio host and global sports anchor for ESPN FC. Please welcome to the show one of my all-time favorite anchors, Borough supporter, Kay Murray. Welcome, Kay.
Hello, Sal. So happy to be here with you. Finally getting to have a good chat with you about loads of topics that I want to touch on.
Yay! That makes me so excited. I'm so excited to have you on, and there is so much to unpack because you have lived and are living every football fan's dream, and you prove that each and every single day that with hard work pays off, but so does kindness. So thank you so much for being here and taking time out of your extremely busy schedule. So we're going to talk about all things from working in Spain to meeting legends at FIFA events to living in Miami and now in Connecticut working for the worldwide leader of sports. That is a tongue twister while being the mom of two. So it's an extraordinary life you've got. I'm so thankful and honored to have you on and to share it. But let's go back to the beginning. So you're from Middlesbrough, which explains your Borough fandom. But what is it like to come from that town, and what does it mean to be a fan of that club?
Yeah, I always say that being from Middlesbrough gives me a true sense of identity, because there is a true sense of identity when it comes to our town. And I've even, like, I had a flatmate in Madrid who once said, you know, I'm from an area that doesn't feel as though it has what yours does. And I know that other areas might have that, she said, and I'm a little bit envious that you have that sense of belonging to the place that you're from. So that's really nice. It's a working class town. It's full of people that you would call salt of the earth. And the football club is like the heartbeat of the town. So I always say that even if you're not a football fan, you'll still know about the football club, how they're doing, because someone in your family is probably a huge fan, who the manager is, who the players are. And that's one thing that you know you can always talk about. Even if it's your nana saying, oh, the Borough are doing terribly, aren't they? There's always a conversation about that. And it's that wonderful thing that wherever you've gone in the world, that sense of identity even comes with other football fans, because they say, oh, you're from Middlesbrough. Do you know about your football team? Do you support your football team? You've instantly got something to talk about when it comes to your football team as well.
So, because my wife tends to laugh at me. She's like, we travel a lot, and everywhere I go, I will talk about this game. And she's like, you have friends everywhere. She's like, you just met someone at the coffee shop, and now, you know, we're going to hang out with them tonight for drinks. It's like, well, this is how it is. It's a passport, and it's a beautiful passport, I feel, when you get to talk about this sport. But the fact that this sport allows people an insight into where you're from immediately, right off the bat, how does that make you feel to, like, have the two of them intertwined together and almost the symbiotic relationship that Middlesbrough and the football club together is what everyone kind of knows about that town?
Yeah, I think that's a source of pride for the town, for the club. And it's funny that you say that it's a passport, because it really is, isn't it? Yeah. And I think that if you say you're a Middlesbrough fan, people cannot doubt that you're a football fan, because they think, oh, hang on, you're either from there or you chose that. And that's, you know, if that's something that's going to build you up for disappointment throughout your life, then you've definitely chosen well there. And that's why, you know, we take things on the chin, because we've been used to disappointment over the years with our team. But it is such a lovely thing. And I usually find, which is really nice, that people don't usually have mean things to say about the football team. Mm-hmm. So even if they're not really that bothered about them, I remember last time we were relegated, and I felt people were saying, oh, you know what? I mean, I don't really follow Borough or anything, but I don't mind them. I'd rather them not go down. I don't want to see them relegated. So it feels as that I think people know that it's one of those clubs that is so central to the town that it's in, and they know how many hearts will be broken, how many people's weekend is made by going to the game with their family, or at least being able to see the results, listen on the radio, and then all meet up afterwards and, you know, have a talk about the club. So I think that people know how much it means to the people of Middlesbrough to have a club like that right in the center of it.
Oh, beautiful. Now, you began your broadcast journalism career in 2002 as a presenter and reporter at Borough TV, the local channel for Middlesbrough. You wrote, co-produced, and hosted Soccer Surgery, Borough TV's weekly program about the club. How did this come about? And did the young woman in North Yorkshire, trying to say that right, over 20 years ago, think she would be where she is today?
I don't think I would have expected to be exactly where I am. I think I would have hoped to have been something, doing something like what I am. But my mum recently found some of the footage. Well, I've always had the footage. It was on old VHS tapes, but she got it all transferred onto a USB for me. It's fascinating watching it back. It's really fun as well. It came about because they were advertising for young people to be the face of the club, men and women, young men and women. And so I went for it. I'd recently been made redundant from a job in London that I was working in. And when I was there, we went to do the photo shoot at where they filmed Borough TV. We were one of the first club channels in the world. I think we were actually the first, like, at least in Europe. But we were on a smaller scale than the likes of Manchester United, who came just after us. So people didn't really care because it was more on a local network. And because we did it there, I knew the executive producer from a long time ago. His parents lived very close to my parents.
Okay.
And I told him that this is what I'd like to get into, journalism, and this is what I was looking at doing. And he said, why don't you come and do some work experience, which I did. While I was doing that work experience, I realized there was a few shows that they had planned. And I just took one of those and ran with it, bombarded them with ideas. In all sorts of different ways. And so they piloted that show with me and my co-presenter, who was a local radio host and still is. And the pilot went well. And so we did it. So it was Friday nights. It was pretty much every other week because it was always the night before a home game.
Mm-hmm.
We would invite a local team. That would be like a local pub team to come, and they would play all the quizzes and the games with us. We'd invite a local celebrity. We'd have a local band from the area, so to promote music. And it was just a lot of fun. And we made fun of whoever we were facing that weekend in the most, like, ridiculous ways. So it was great. And it's what gave me the understanding of being on camera. Seeing some of my early stuff is wild. You know, they say no one's a natural. And it's, I think there's a lot of truth in that. I think you always maybe have a natural ability in front of camera. You always do or you don't. Mm. But you're definitely green in the beginning, even if you do have that natural ability. And that was definitely the case with me back then. And so, yeah, from there was a girl who used to do all the pitch side stuff on the match day, interview the players. She was always in the mix zone, cutting her reports afterwards. And I thought, that's what I want to do. How did you get to do that?
Mm-hmm.
And she said, well, I studied journalism. And I was like, okay, that's what I need to do then. So I actually went the other way about it.
Oh.
In that I got on the local TV station before I'd actually studied journalism. And so it's a bit of a different story to a lot of other people's.
But that's what makes it so incredibly unique. And you never gave up. And that's the thing, you presented your ideas, you did what you had to do, and to make this dream as fulfilling as it is now. But then you made the jump from Middlesbrough to unquestionably probably the biggest team of all time in any sport across the planet, where you went and started working at Real Madrid TV and covered Los Blancos for a number of years, entertaining years at that, with Mourinho at the helm, the early years of Ronaldo and at the club, and Kaká as well. What was that experience like? And were you a fan of La Liga before taking that job?
It was the most wonderful experience one of the most wonderful experiences I've had in my working life. And I'm so glad it happened to me. And I'm so glad I took the opportunity. Was I a fan of La Liga beforehand? I had a slight interest in Spanish football, but not like I was following the Premier League at the time. I suppose we always knew what was going on with Real Madrid and Barcelona loosely. Just in general, most football fans kind of would. But then once I went there and started to understand and learn the culture of Spanish football, it even went beyond then everything I did with Real Madrid, because I traveled with the team to all the away games in the Champions League as well. But actually getting to see Spain and all the different parts of Spain, and because we were the international channel, we would do reports on those cities, the cultural nuances there, just really nice little things that might not have been as interesting to a Spanish-speaking audience or the Spanish. as it was to our international audience. So it was almost like a travel show as well at times. That's and then awesome. On top of that, we're like in our 20s, living in Madrid with all our friends. We get to go for free to watch Real Madrid play at the Bernabeu. Or if not there, I'm sat on a flight with the players traveling around the country or Europe. So it was just incredible. And then even back in the office, like the mixture of Spanish, young Spanish journalists and these young international journalists is just an experience that was, it opened my eyes so much, learning a new language, learning a new culture. And it also showed us, oh, wow, I can actually move, I can move to another country and survive here. And little things like even getting what would be like the equivalent of your social security number.
Oh, wow.
Being able to do that, because nobody changes for you in Madrid. It's very Spanish in a lot of ways. So no one's helping you if you don't speak a lot of Spanish in these government buildings. Yeah. And so it's almost like a tick and an achievement every time you would get to do these things, this young challenge for yourself. And it really did arm me with a lot of skills to then go forward after that to the other places that I've lived in the world.
Wow. Wow. It's, you know, there's so much has been said about Real Madrid and so many books have been written about them, but not just as the history of the team, but how they operate as a club and as a business. And I hate using business in football, but when you're the best at what you do, and by no stretch am I like a huge Madridista, as someone would say, I guess. But it is interesting to see how successful they are, especially in the big money era of football that we're in now, seeing the inner workings of how that board works and how they strive to not only be the best, but continue to be the best and set themselves up for long-term, not just immediate success, but long-term success. What was that like for you to even see that from coming? And this is not to say like Borough is a small club, they're a historic club, but to go from one scale to something the size of the Bernabeu and beyond, you know, what was that like for you to witness that?
Yeah, I mean, that it was really quite something, as you say, because there is a ruthlessness to it in the way that you'll see managers sacked and you think, oh my goodness. Or you know that even if they've done everything they could, but just fell short of one area, especially if it was finishing behind Barcelona or missing out on the Champions League, which happened for many a year while I was there. You could see that was that and you were done. And even with certain players, you just saw this, like, as you say, there's that real business side to it. But there were so many things about it that just still had the prestige that came with it. Like even walking into that stadium every single time, especially if you walk from the ground up and you walk up the steps to like the stadium opens out around you and you see the pitch laid before you. And then you have that sense of who stepped on that pitch over those years, over decades of just incredible players or successes that have happened there. And the players that you would see there who also knew, for the most part, exactly where they were playing, the pull and the draw that that club still had, the way that if there was a top name player and they went out for them, you pretty much knew you were going to get them. The Spanish sports papers every single day still managing to fill their pages with rumours, with talk, with everything to do with that club. It's quite incredible, really, when you see it. Even just the way the Bernabeu was just wham in the middle of this capital city of Madrid, which you don't obviously always see in football, and it's just there. Like, that in itself, it's more of like a spaceship-looking thing now, and I can't wait to see in its new form. But Sid Lowe was recently saying inside it's still exactly the same, that same wonderful atmosphere.
Wow.
And if it's possible, maybe even a better atmosphere because there is a roof now. It's even more contained. And so I don't know, there's something very special and very magical about the stadium that links into them trying to be the biggest and the best at everything they do.
It really is. Like they look at every detail, and the fact that it's not only just a roofed building now, but there's a retractable field. Like, how insane is that? Like,
I know.
It's also like, I sit here in New York City and I know MetLife Stadium is not that far from where I am. And it was like a couple $1 billion to build this thing that looks like something out of the Cold War. It is not attractive. It is not a nice stadium. And yet, for the same price, Real Madrid at the Bernabeu have got a retractable field and a roof. Like,
yeah.
it blows my mind, like how things are done elsewhere, but also, again, here's this team that has constantly led the way doing it again. It's quite shocking. And to see,
and then remember, Sal, as well, like, that leads to, obviously it's retractable now, but even when the groundsman back in the day, they would then go and find the best groundsman in the world, right, at the time.
Yes.
They're like, okay, that's the best one in the world. Well, we want him as well. Like, it extended beyond players. They want the best person in every role there at that club.
Wow. So they would get the Figo of groundskeepers to then go from Barcelona to Real Madrid and say,
yes. And even with the television station, it's like, when, okay, it's changed now, but back then they were always trying to be one step ahead. It's like, okay, we have an in-house Spanish-speaking station. Let's go international as well. We need an English-speaking team that can do this too. That in itself, it was just brilliant. Like, so ahead of its time.
Yeah, yeah, it's, wow, amazing. You know, following Real Madrid TV, you went over to BeIn, where you met your husband, the great Matteo Bonetti. Let's please try and get him on the podcast one day. At BeIn, you continued your La Liga coverage, but also dove into the French Ligue 1, Italian Serie A, Turkish Super League, AFCON. Did it become a whirlwind world of football for you?
Yes, is the answer to that. But I think it was you, Sal. What? How is it you describe your job? You described once what it's like being a journalist.
I mean, I have different nuances for it every day. One is like, it's the most thankless job that everyone wants.
It was something to do with just that your job is about researching and just...
Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, you do professional homework for a living.
That's professional homework. That was it. See, I love this description because that's how it was. And some people, the nerds among us, love homework if it's a topic we like. And so that's how I feel about football. So when people were like, okay, you need to learn these leagues. And I was like, wonderful. I'm going to find the stories that people don't know to bring these leagues to the masses. And that's how I always felt. It felt like a task for me. Going back to Serie A was amazing because that is something that I grew up on.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In the 90s in England, we were shown Italian football and none of us missed it. And so we all grew up, people of my age, watching Italian football, especially in its heyday. So that was great to be able to go back to that. I'd always had a big interest as well in Italian football. French league, like so many of the stars of today's game were coming through this league, and we were almost getting like protective when they were getting to the bigger, like to the heights and being the big names in the transfer windows. Like, hey, we knew them when they were 15 and coming through at Monaco. So you'd get that feeling as well about it. But then it just really does help because As you know, with football, that is how it works. Players come through, they'll end up at the biggest teams eventually, the biggest and the best. And you already have been following them for such a long time with the more leagues you cover. And just as we talk about moving to Spain like I did and all the things you'd learn there, covering all these different tournaments, as you mentioned, AFCON, all these different leagues, you just learn so much as well about the places where the football's played, about the players, about the differences in these leagues and these competitions and these international teams, that I think that really does help you in your job too.
I love it. You know, and it showed, and anytime I have someone on from BeIn, I just have to express my sincere gratitude. I had Andre Cordero on in the past. I've had Georgi Metellus on. I've had Thomas Rongen. Now you. Thank you. It's for me, and I think I speak on behalf of a lot of passionate football fans in America. It was the first time we saw something that wasn't speaking down to us, where it's like no one had to explain, this is an offside, and this is the team in red is Manchester United. It was just, if you know this sport, this is the channel for you. And it was on all the time in this house. Like, there was never a moment where it wasn't on. If I was home, if I was in the office, it was a different story. But it was always on. And it was something that I got to appreciate other leagues because of the passion and the intellect and the discussions that you all had. Especially, I miss the locker room so much. I miss you moderating this room full of this testosterone full room of men of different age groups and different backgrounds all going at each other. And then there's Kay coming in with like a samurai sword and being like, well, lads, this is how it's done. And it was just like your control of everything, but also just, it was the best football education I think I've ever had in my life, because not only was I learning more about the leagues that I love and players that I love, but it was now I got to see a window into other places as well. So thank you for that. There's not a question there. It's just
no, I know, but thank you for saying that, because from those of us that you saw on screen, right down to the production staff, to the people who were just coming in, everybody was invested. Everybody was on the same page. Everybody knew the leagues inside out. It's La Liga that brought me there, because obviously they got the rights to La Liga. And so I'm very thankful for that as well. But it was a really great team of people who off camera were all out together as well. We've been all good friends, and it was an excellent breeding ground as well for so many of those people who've gone on to other networks since. And yeah, the locker room was just, it was brilliant. It was so much fun. I miss it, actually. I miss it all. I'm very lucky now to be working as part of a daily talk show again with a lot of similarities.
Yeah. So that's great too. It's how you discussed watching players from the French League at that time on the come up. That's how I kind of feel about all of you as broadcasters, when seeing Ian Joy then do NYCFC coverage for a while, and then seeing Kevin Egan go to WWE. I was like, oh my God, I know all these guys. I know. It was as if like you were all friends of mine. And it was just, I've never met you. And it just, there was this like extreme joy and proudness that I had as a viewer, because you can tell nobody was phoning it in. All of you just, you know, to have Ray Hudson and Phil Schoen, that is just like drinking two of the most beautiful bottles of wine ever. And like, as commentators, like so that was just that level of all of that. And in the midst of all of this, during your time at BN, you also presented at the FIFA Ballon d'Or ceremony alongside footballer Ruud Gullit, which Matteo and I are both AC Milan supporters, so I'm going to touch on that in a little bit. But what was it like hosting that ceremony and presenting the Ballon d'Or to Messi at a time when that rivalry was at fever pitch?
Well, that in itself was a story, to be honest. So first of all, To be the girl from Middlesbrough that got chosen to host the Ballon d'Or was an incredible sense of pride for me and for my family as well. And I think for the people of our town as well. And so it was great. It was a wonderful experience. And the chance, getting the chance to do it twice, just made it even more unreal to me and unbelievable. But at the time, as you say, there was a lot of animosity between the two teams. It had really reached fever pitch. So there was all those Clasicos. Like, I think I still have a Facebook album called something like 7 Clasicos in 6 weeks. It was that type of feeling. I can't remember what it was off the top of my head now, but it was that. They were in the semifinals of the Champions League. There was the Clasicos as well. There was the Copa del Rey final. It was just this whole run, as you remember, of Clasicos with Mourinho and Pep at the helm. And yeah, it was just getting uglier and uglier. I was in the press conference when Pep asked, which camera's Mourinho's? We know that he's the you-know-what in here.
Wow.
And so just being part, it actually got to the point where it was almost getting ugly and just working. And I'm sure it felt the same for people working with Inside Barcelona at the time. It just felt like a little bit too much in the end. But anyway, when I look back, I'm so glad I was a part of it. So that in itself was tough, because the first Ballon d'Or, I was still a Real Madrid TV presenter. Yeah, and the second Ballon d'Or was at BeIN. So it was like that crossover for me. And at the time, I remember getting asked by Jose Mourinho himself just questions about it on the team plane. Like, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? And he didn't really say anything, but it was just quite strange to even be getting asked about it.
Right.
Why I'd be doing that. And obviously he has the control that he does, and he's the manager he is. And maybe they didn't want that, the presence of me there at a time when it was clearly obvious my first Ballon d'Or was just a complete Barcelona sweep. They took everything. So that was quite hard for me, because I thought they can't stop me doing this. Surely he can't stop me doing this. And he didn't, and nothing was ever said. But I had the sense that they were trying to work out, did I know anything more? I don't know what he was thinking.
Wow.
When he found out I was doing it, he asked, I got asked to go up to the team plane to go and talked to him more about it and just got asked a few questions about it. Anyway, on the stage that night, Real Madrid weren't there. They had a game and they obviously decided not to go. But we did have Real Madrid representation there in the form of Zinedine Zidane and Emilio Butragueño. And I always remember Emilio Butragueño being so kind about me. And he just said, what a great representation you were for our club on that stage tonight. Even though, of course, that wasn't my role. I was representing FIFA. I'd been employed by them. But it was a really nice thing to say at a time when I was wondering, will I get into trouble for doing this when it's right. a very Barcelona-heavy award ceremony tonight? But of course I didn't, and no one ever said anything. I was just trying to gauge if that's what... I couldn't tell what Mourinho was thinking when he was asking me those things.
Sometimes I shudder to think that, like, he even knows sometimes what he, you know, he loves that. He's the king of the mind game. He really is. But there's no way you would even know what the outcome would be ahead of time anyway. So
no. I decided, so like I told those close to me, I said, no one at the club, no one at the television station ever said my job was in danger.
Right.
But I just said, if it is a choice, when I told my boss, like I had to speak to Mourinho on the plane about it. And he was like, well, what if they don't want you to do it? And I said, I'm just telling you now, I'm not turning this opportunity down. I'm not. This is too big an opportunity to turn down. And I'm not doing anything wrong. And as I say, it was nothing and no one from Real Madrid saying otherwise.
Yeah.
As I just said, there was a representation there. So that in itself was really quite an interesting moment. Yeah. That happened.
Wow. And you had shared the stage with Ruud Gullit. As I said, we're going to get back to that. And he was always like the coolest guy ever on the field. Is he as cool and collected and calm as he is on stage and in person? I mean, I know there's a story about you, him, and Pelé.
Yes, there is. Well, first of all, yes, he's more than cool, calm, and collected. He's like a real joker.
Oh,
he's really funny. So he's just a really funny guy to be around. And what's really funny is he said that when Capello first came in at Milan, he'd look down the dinner table at Ruud, and Ruud would do an impression of how he would be at the table, you know, all very relaxed and laughing. And for Capello, he was like, what's going on here? What is this? God. So it's funny that he's obviously always been that way. So he was a very, very easy person to be around. And I've been fortunate enough to be around him many more times after that, working with Bean as well. But yes, he was also very kind in that before the ceremony, you have to spend time in the auditorium, getting used to the stage, going through your rehearsals. And then all the players that will be involved, whether they're presenting awards, up for an award, winning an award, which obviously they don't know at that point,
mm-hmm.
they'll all come through at some point in the day just so you can talk to them a little bit and talk them through what will be happening with FIFA officials, of course. And a lot of them came through, and it's funny because I just didn't flinch. I'd been working for Real Madrid for many a year then. So I was like, oh, yeah,
I'm not starstruck anymore.
Not even a big deal anymore. Oh, there's Xavi. Great. You know, it was very much that, oh, there's Ronaldo. Hi, Cristiano. How are you doing? So in that sense, like, I was just used to being around all those people, wasn't starstruck. But then Pelé came in, and I had to take a breath. Because then that, especially growing up loving the sport and falling in love with the sport during the 1990 World Cup, which obviously that's after Pelé's time, but just some of those legends would still be walking through. But still, his name for any football fan, whatever country you're from, is always part of your football fandom. And so when he walked in, I thought, oh, wow, I'm genuinely starstruck now and I don't know what to do. And then Ruud says, come on, let's go see Pelé. And they're chatting away, and Ruud does the kindest thing and says, oh, you know what, Pelé, it's been a while since you and I got a picture together, but okay, why don't you get one with him? Stand there, pass me your phone, let me take a picture with you two. And so Ruud took away me having to ask Pelé for a picture. I hadn't even mentioned it, he just knew. Like, who wouldn't? Everybody wants that, don't they? He made it about him and then had me take the picture of the two of them. And there I have this picture with Pelé that I didn't even have to ask for, which I'm sure he would have given me. But it was just such a kind and thoughtful thing of Ruud to do that night.
It truly is. And it's also a story that you get to now then eventually tell your boys and say, so I've got this photo with Pelé and Ruud Gullit took it. So there, but now it's one of those, like, that is, that's the ultimate right there. And oh, and by the way, this is happening at a Ballon d'Or ceremony. And the prize may have gone to Messi, but I won the biggest trophy of them all. Like, that, you have the best story right there out of all of that. It's a remarkable life and it's a remarkable career that you have, and you're still going and you're still amazing, and you're at ESPN now, still doing La Liga and also Bundesliga, an authority on both of those leagues, and you've made a career of being an authority of whatever league you are covering. Does it ever become overwhelming and absorbing so much, because you're absorbing so much information on these different leagues, styles, players, managers, languages, cultures, all of that?
It can definitely become overwhelming, I'm not going to lie, because they're the leagues that obviously we have the rights to at ESPN. Mm-hmm. But on top of that, ESPN talks about everything anyway.
Yep.
And it's not rights dependent. So being part of a daily soccer show, you talk about all the biggest topics in the world of football, whether it's this side of the world, over this side of the pond, the Premier League biggest topics, Spain, Italy, France, PSG, all what's going on there. You constantly have to be dialed in. So even your days off, yeah, they're your days off, but you need to make sure you've not missed the show that you're not on, because a lot of those topics and those debates will be carrying over to the next show. Later on in the week, you need to remember if two people disagreed on it, if it's on your show and that topic comes back up. So it can get overwhelming quite a lot of the time, and especially as someone who always over-prepared too, which I think you'll find a lot of women say that in this industry. I think that from years and years of feeling that we have to make sure and prove ourselves, we've often overcompensated when it comes to research and the work that we put in. But I've started to learn as I've got older, and especially since I've become a mom, how to put things into different boxes, what to prioritize, that you don't need to know every single part of it. You just need to know the biggest talking points, the results, what the point from it is. And so it can be overwhelming, but it's also great, because once you are in it and you've been doing it for a long time, it just becomes second nature, and you already know all these topics, and you're listening to podcasts on the way into work to get even more information, to get different views on things. And of course, on ESPN FC, I'm talking to former players all the time, and really top journalists as well. So you can pick whoever you need to talk to about it. You can give one of those journalists a call if you need to know more about this or that. You can speak to the players if it's a situation in the Premier League that you're unsure about. You can call Derek Ray if you need to know if this is a normal thing in Germany that would usually happen. You just really do have all these wonderful resources around you to help you.
Oh, that's incredible. And it's good to know that there's a teamwork involved in all of this, and that everyone's there to support each other. I mean, in the end, you just want the best product imaginable. And as you said earlier, there was something that, you know, being a woman in this field, you feel like you had to at one point overcompensate, and it's still something that is like ingrained in you now. You're a trailblazer here because you're one of the few women anchors in this game that we love. What do you want all the young girls to know that are listening about your journey and rise to the top, and just any advice you would give any young lady coming up that wants to be the next Kay Murray?
So I do want it for the young women, of course, but I also hope, and this proves we've come a long way, that I continue to hear from young men in the industry too.
That's
because in the same way that I would reach out to a male anchor that I might have wanted information from, I hope that they now look to us women in this role as the norm. And yeah. So I do get a lot of young men asking me advice and things too. So I hope that they still reach out to me. But as for the young women, to just be yourself, and to, I suppose there's a big point of it where you're always going to feel like you have to prove yourself. But as long as you know your product and you care about it, then you're going to be okay. You're going to be fine. Listen to advice, watch the anchors and the journalists, and read the writers who you like, to find your voice, to see what works for you, to see their comfortability in front of camera, to just learn everything you can and take as much in as you can. But the big, big one, well, there's two big ones, actually. One is reps. Reps is massive. Mm-hmm. The more you do it, the better you get at it. So any reps you can get, whether it's if you're at university and it's on the student campus, if it's in the whatever broadcast facilities you have there, if there's a news team, if you get to go and report on the local sports team or the university, the college sports team, do it. Those reps are so important, whether you set up your own little YouTube channel, whether you're just practicing at home every night. Reps are just so important at getting better at what you do. And then when you dare watch yourself back, which isn't always everyone's favorite thing to do, you'll start to notice things you might, yeah. But you'll start to see things and words and cruxes that you have that you're like, I need to cut that out. I always fall back on that word or that phrase, or I could have done that better. So that's really helping. That helps you to be self-critical. Take the constructive criticism on board. Don't think that you're going to be perfect and a natural straight away. Even if everyone's told you, oh, you're great at this, you can always learn more. We even hear footballers now saying, I think it was Gundogan in a recent interview with Dan Thomas at ESPN, who said he thought he knew everything when he went to Man City. And then he started playing under Pep Guardiola. And this is a professional footballer. And he was like, oh gosh, I don't think I know anything actually. There's always more to learn in everything you do, and you can always better yourself. So that's one really important thing. The other one is you can have the path you want to take. You can look at where you hope to be, say like, oh, I want to work for ESPN, but it doesn't have to be the route that you expect it, and it probably won't be. So if a door opens, that's still, it might be a little bit of a sideway move, but it's still on the way to it, and there's still experience to be gained, then take it. Two examples for me was that when I was studying journalism, I made money by working on shopping television, which is like QVC.
Yeah.
What did that do for me? Well, it paid my studies, but it also got me used to talking to fill time on camera. Yeah, about, I don't know, fluffy towels and kettles and jewelry. But it gave me some really strong skills in talking on screen, in trying to be engaging with my audience, in trying to be funny when I needed to be. And then from there, I took a step, I'd say a massive sideways step, and in some ways a step forward, but people saw it as a step back, in that I went to work on a local paper in London. Mm-hmm. And so I was a written journalist writing about local news, education, sports sometimes, but mainly like education, crime, those type of things. But that gave me an insane amount of skills learning about media law. But guess what? They all ended up being a part of my path, being a part of who I am. So don't turn down an opportunity that comes up for you because you don't think it's what you wanted to do. It might just be something you need that's going to give you the most skills. Like Patrick Mahomes, let's go to the NFL now. Patrick Mahomes, there's a show on Netflix where it's called Quarterback, and he was an amazing baseball player. And now he's obviously one of the best quarterbacks ever. And I'm not going to get into arguments about that, but I'm just saying he's a quarterback that has amazing skills that he says has come from the fact that he played baseball. Like the way he throws has come from that. So my point is, by going off into the other football here, and it's just to use it as an example,
for sure,
you can go and do something else that will actually benefit you in the end in a way that you might not have imagined.
Absolutely. I am a prime example of that in my career. My wife is as well. It's, and so are you. And it's sometimes the unorthodox way, and I don't mean like in a salacious way, but like sometimes the unorthodox way of doing things is the best, because you it's almost like Slumdog Millionaire, where you just pick up all these things at once, and then in the end,
that's a good example.
you're sitting at a game show, and maybe one day you'll need to know who all three musketeers are, but because of one event in your life or one thing that you did, you'll have that answer. But it's something that you have done, and again, you inspire so many folks and you inspire so many people, that your platform has grown exponentially over the years, and rightfully so. And you decided to bring fans into your personal life and discuss your journey to pregnancy and the trials and tribulations of IVF. You are now a mom of two adorable young boys who I'm sure will be kicking around a ball in no time, thanks to their parents. But why did you choose to share that? And what was it like for you to let the world in on your private life?
It was a very conscious decision to share it. It came from looking myself when I decided to embark on IVF, or actually look into it. Mm-hmm. Before we made the decision we were going to go ahead with it, I was looking everywhere online. I realized now I was looking in the wrong places, because there's so much information out there. But I was trying to find someone just so I could identify with them, because of course there's a lot of women who share their stories, but I was trying to find someone from our industry who'd shared a story similar. And this is back in, I'm talking about back in 2018, really, because it's obviously a long process when you're even, maybe even as far back as 2017, when you're looking at taking those steps, because now there's a lot more information out there. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, you know what? And I completely understand and respect those who decide to keep it to themselves, which is why probably a lot of it hasn't been shared. But I thought, I'm going to make sure that I share what I can, in the hope that if there's anybody else like me and they're looking for it, they can find, oh, that person is in broadcasting, she did it, or she's like a public figure and she did it. And to just try and share some of the stories. And now I see so many more, and I always try and reach out to people to say, you know, thanks for sharing your story. It's wonderful to see, but it's a very brutal and very tough road. And the wonderful thing for me was that by sharing my story, I also heard from a lot of men as well, I think can often be forgotten in this journey, because obviously it's the woman's body that has to go through, and not just men as well, partners too. But it's the woman's body that has to go through so much when it comes to IVF. But the emotional side of it, she goes through as well, of course, but so too do the partners. And so it was really nice to hear from the partners as well, because you're much more likely to ask the person going through IVF, are you okay? How are you doing? But a lot of people forget about the partners as well, who are also going through such a really intense, hard time, such an emotional journey, often having to administer injections to their partner when they don't have a medical background and things like this. So I hoped that that would help. And just sharing your story and sharing your, using your platform to help, was wonderful. And something else that I found was really, really nice by sharing the story is that people who have decided not to go public with their story, which they have no reason to, would reach out to me privately to say, oh, you're not alone, I've been through this too.
Oh, wow.
And I was thinking, that's so kind that it was something they chose to keep to themselves, which they have every right to do. And they still decided to share their story with me in the hope that it might help me. So I thought that that's part of the reason that I did it. And yeah, here I am now. Two of them.
It's what's incredible, though, and this is where, you know, we all have to just applaud every woman ever. Like, you would, as an audience, as someone watching it, you would never know the trials and tribulations of backstage, or what's going on off camera, or what's going on in the, and none of this is any of my business or any of our businesses, but the level of consistent, I'm going to make up a word here, amazingness that we would constantly see get emitted from you on a daily basis as you were going through this, and you're keeping the most positive outlook, you're having to put a smile on your face while there's like, God only knows what's going on, you know, and there's so much raging. It's so much happening.
I can actually, I can go back and see the footage of the days where I know I've been giving myself injections that morning in my stomach. Wow. I know the days when I was I'm actually on air on a digital show on the day when I was waiting to find out my first blood test to see if my embryo transfer had actually been successful. And I was just waiting on air thinking, am I pregnant or am I not pregnant? Just all these moments. And I know that obviously I'm not alone in that. There's so many people, and that extends beyond IVF as well. There's people on air who may have just lost a loved one, who may have just been told there's a diagnosis of something in their lives. So just all sorts of things where it's one of the things about having to go on camera. It's one of the hardest things that you just have to carry on regardless as normal. So that was interesting too. And like, I mean, I came up to New Jersey to do an event with David Villa's group, with Unai Emery. We did a big talk with, it was like a coaching seminar then, and I was moderating it. And I was in the later stages then of my IVF journey, where I already knew I was pregnant, but you have to hope that the pregnancy is going to continue to hold and continue to be a healthy one in your body. So you have to continue with certain medications. And some of the later medications are bigger, bigger needles that you have to inject yourself with, which usually you have somebody in your life that helps you do that. But when you go on the road and you're traveling, it's stuff you're going to have to do yourself. And I thought, oh, gosh, I don't really want to ask Unai Emery or any of his team to have to do this. So that's when you start to realize what you are capable of and that you can actually be a contortionist as well, because you'll start to think, okay, I know I have to administer this injection. And I'm sure there are like diabetics laughing at me now, even just saying this, like it's a big deal, who've lived their lives having to give themselves injections and stuff. But so you think, okay, I'm going to be able to do this. I'm going to have to do this. It's for the safety and the health of my baby. And I'm going to have to, in this little hotel room in Long Island, I was. In this little hotel room, I'm going to have to do this. In this little fridge that was given to me for probably what they thought would be like a mini bar. No, this is where all my little medications are. And you don't realize your own strengths, you know. And I think that just applies to everybody. You're so much stronger and braver than you know so much of the time.
It's, you know, knowing that so many couples and so many women go through the challenges of getting pregnant and the costs and the mystery of what IVF may or may not bring. What do you want people to know who are going through this now? What do you want couples to know?
Well, first of all, that you aren't alone. Mm-hmm. And everybody's journey and story is different, and everybody's outcome can be different too. But to know that you're not alone, to reach out, try and find groups, maybe support groups. They are out there. Once you start to scratch the surface, you will see more people who are very open with it. You'll find out so many more people than you would have even imagined have fertility issues. You'll see people with kids that you never even would have thought for a minute had any type of issue. And nearly everybody has some type of story about fertility to share with you. So that does lead into you not being alone. And that there are always avenues for everybody, whatever it may be. And obviously IVF and it being successful is the dream for so many. But if parenthood really is your dream, there are also options beyond that. And just for everybody to know, to never give up and to always look for what you can do to achieve your dream. And to go back to what we were saying, it might not be the conventional route that you thought it would be, but if it's something you want to happen for you, you know, just look at what is out there for you. And it's hard to say, because I know I'm very, very lucky that IVF worked for us, and I'm so fortunate with that. I know people personally for whom it hasn't worked, and I just always just want to give my love and support to all of those people, because I just know what that feels like to go through it. But I can't imagine how hard it can be when it's not happening for those people too, because it's just a physical journey as it is, then with all the emotion on top of that, it just feels so unfair.
Yeah, having seen friends go through it, and again, lucky and not, and you know, maybe sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't happen. Both of those situations, it's rough, and I applaud anyone that wants to go down this road. And you know, and thank you for your beautiful words to just encouragement for others. You know, it's incredible now to see that like your story has evolved in the sense that you're a working mom with kids, who especially two young boys who always want their mama. And as any Italian boy will tell you, I know my mom is going to listen to this podcast and probably mutter, "You're damn right." But being in a field that it's so demanding, always challenging, always changing, always needing so much more of your time and travel as well, how do you do it all, Kay?
Not too sure, to be sometimes. I spoke to somebody else in the industry, and she was very, very helpful, and she became a mum before. In fact, I've spoken to a few mums before me who are in the industry, like, and asked them questions. And something that really stood out to me was in wanting to always give 100% in everything I do. I spoke to somebody who is so great at what she does, and I won't share names or anything, but I said, I know how you are and you always give 100%. So how does it work now? Because I can't give 100%. And she was like, well, that's the point. You can't, because you can't give 100% to every one of those things anymore. And that's okay. Mm-hmm. As long as you're giving as much as you can to each of those areas, that's what matters most. And that's good enough, because you're not alone. So many other people are having to do this, that as long as you're giving the best you can, it doesn't matter if it's not 100%, because it's impossible. It's too much of a juggling act for it to be 100% here and 100% there. And that was really nice advice for me. And I was like, if they say that, I feel way better.
Yeah, that's incredible. And I think we live in such a demanding society, especially in this country too, where it's like, hey, your job has got to be your biggest thing. And I think the pandemic finally made people turn around and say, like, well, it's important. It's there. It's the thing. It is a thing, but it is not the thing.
Yeah, that's massive, isn't it? And do you know what? Just becoming a parent's done that to me, because it's suddenly something so much bigger than anything I've ever had before.
Yeah.
That's so much more important to me than anything else now. That will always be first.
Yeah,
but it doesn't mean that anything else has to take gone forever.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's nice too. But you know what else is really nice that I think the pandemic's also brought us? There's a relaxedness now. I don't even know if that's a word.
I made up a couple words together. Today. It's fine.
And there's a way now that sometimes being so polished, it doesn't always have to be like that. Mm. Like naturally, we're going to make mistakes, and it's so nice to be in an era where you can be on air, you can get your words mixed up, the words don't come out, you say the wrong team, it's fun, it doesn't matter, it's not a big deal. Like there have been bigger deals than you saying the wrong word on air today, or the wrong team. It's you said Real Madrid instead of Barcelona, you didn't even realize, oh no, it's really not that big a deal.
It's so true. I'm a huge rock and roll fan, and the beauty of rock and roll is that the beauty of rock and roll is all about imperfection. And that's, I think, the human element to what makes great things is imperfection. And as you said, there's so many more important things. There are children that can't eat, and there are so many other things that we can be pontificating and getting angry about, but it's okay. It's okay to make a mistake every once in a while. It's totally fine. It's not.
Yeah, exactly.
None of this is great.
Especially in our jobs. Yeah. I love my job. It's wonderful. I'm so privileged to do it. But hey, I am like very lucky. I get to go to work and talk about football every day. There are people doing actual really important jobs of value. And like they're the ones who are really under pressure way more than we are, just sitting in front of a camera talking about a sport where, you know, people kick a football around. Like there are much more important things in life and much more important jobs in life than ours.
Yeah, it's very true. But the work even doesn't stop for you when you go home. You make things a family affair, as you and Mateo host the Fantastic City Out podcast. And again, if you're ever looking for a guest, you know where to find me, Kay. But what is it like to come together on that, on one project, and talk about the thing that you love, despite the both of you working in the same field, talking about that all day long?
It actually does work as some homework for me, Sal.
Oh, okay.
Because there's another league that I have an expert sat next to me on, so I can ask all the questions, especially if I've been on La Liga and Bundesliga duty all weekend and missed a little bit of what's been going on. Okay, this is a great little reset for me to know how my week ahead is. It's something really nice for us. We've found a way to make it part of, you know, maybe you go out for dinner, you have a date night. Mm-hmm. Instead of it feeling so work related, we will sit down and kick back. It's behind a paywall, so it feels like we are a bit more relaxed. We trust our patrons. They almost feel like friends to us. They're allowed to ask us questions every week. We have like we kind of feel like we know them, even though we haven't met many of them. So that's really nice as well. And just having that. I know you just said, like, you just had a little joke there saying, you know, if you ever want a guest, I can come on. I think something else we'd said is that, you know, if a guest works, we'll get them on. But what we have the absolute, like, at our disposal here is our house and our recording equipment. We're a couple. We can jump on whenever we want.
Yeah.
Like, we can make content whenever we want. And I suppose that's a lesson for anyone. Like, you can get content from your own house if you've got the right equipment and get it out there. And so when we're not dependent on, oh, can this guest make it this week, can this guest not, it's fine, because we know we can always talk every single week about the product Serie A that we're talking about. He's been doing it all weekend anyway. Yeah. So we ask about the biggest talking points. Our patrons know so much. They're a big part of the show.
Yeah.
Because they'll often ask the questions almost like a host would. Questions that cause debate, questions that cause a bit of pushback. So yeah, it's It's been going quite a while now, and it was never meant to be me. Who's doing it with other people to begin with? And just the way life works, commitments elsewhere for those other people meant that he could have either done it alone, or he could have just relied on that host that he lives with to help him out. And that's how it all came.
It's a beautiful partnership, and it's a beautiful idea. And I love the message, though, is that just do it. Just do it. Like, this microphone that I'm talking to you on cost me $20 on Amazon. The hard drive that is recording this episode was an extra $60. I'm not going to say that, like, things under $100 aren't a lot of money, because everything costs so much these days. But you don't need, like, the top of the line gear. But just do it and fail. And fail miserably in front of folks. But that's, and pick yourself back up and then do it again. And one day you can get a paywall and get people going. It's like, it's a great message, though, because we live in an era where I remember as a kid wanting to make Steven Spielberg movies, but equipment was so expensive. If I had an iPhone as a child, it would have been the most amazing
story.
Oh my God. Like, wow, where my life would have ended up. But we live in an era now that, like, you can get all this junk and easy things on Amazon, or I'm not pushing Amazon, they don't sponsor this podcast, but or anywhere you can,
but if they want to,
I am not hey Jeff, I know you're very much into football these days, by all means give me a call, pal. It's an amazing thing that, yeah, and you can do it at your own leisure. Like, this is happening when you and I both have time, we're not on a deadline, and let's just hang out and have fun.
Yeah, well, and that's especially it with our podcast. It's like, we usually try and make it at the same time. We usually want to do bonus content in the week, especially if there's Champions League rounds with Italian teams playing in them. Mm-hmm. But now and again, we just can't make it, but we're not answering to anybody. Yeah. We obviously owe it to our patrons. It might be a day late sometimes. But in that sense, it's like, okay, when can we sit down? When can we do this?
Yeah, it's great. And where can people find it?
They can find it on patreon.com, or if you follow either of us on X, formerly known as Twitter, we always share the link every single episode. And now and again, we open up the episodes for free for everybody. And if, there probably is a backlog somewhere of some older ones if you did want to get an idea of what it's about. But if you're trying to get into Serie A or Italian football in general, or you already are into it, it's probably a good one to go and listen to.
Now time for a coffee break.
Curva Mundial is sponsored by Mod Cup Coffee in Jersey City, but you can get it anywhere in the world from modcup.com. Mod Cup, drink modern coffee. Use code MUNDIAL for 10% off your first order.
And now we're into the fun part of this podcast, three rapid fire questions. Kay Murray, just want to say thank you for everything. And we're going to dive right in. This is going to pertain to Burrow. If you could bring back one retired player to your club, alive or dead, who would it be and why?
Easy peasy. He's alive. It's not even from that long ago. It is Janino. And I don't know many who would say otherwise. It would be Janino, Janino, Janino.
If Middlesbrough had more money than the Saudi Pro League, more money than PSG and City combined, and we're going to play Ultimate Fantasy Football, and they could sign one active player today, who would it be and why?
Oh gosh, that's tough, isn't it? Right now, it would be between Kylian Mbappe and Jude Bellingham. And that's tough. I feel that Jude might be able I don't think it would be too much of a stretch and too much of a cultural shock for Jude growing up in Birmingham to go to Middlesbrough, and he could be pulling all the strings from the midfield or in other positions, as we've seen. Yeah. So let's say Jude Bellingham.
Okay, love it. Yeah. And finally, what has been your favorite moment as a fan of this game? Oh, and you have so many, I know this. Yeah. So if you want to rattle off a bunch.
So many. Okay, there's a few. One was being I saw my team win their only ever cup in their history, the Carling Cup in 2004 in Cardiff. And the weird thing about that was it was amazing. But as soon as the celebration stopped on the pitch, I have never wanted to be home more than I did that night. And I don't know who had the better experience, those of us in the stadium to see it live, or those who were in all the pubs and all the homes in Middlesbrough watching it with family and friends, celebrating, and then getting to stay out or celebrate the whole night after that in the town where the club's from. So that was a really amazing moment. And I think something that really, really stood out to me, just because of the years that I've followed the game and loved the game like I have, is getting to go to my first ever World Cup in Brazil in 2014. Oh, and we arrived late to the game between Spain and Netherlands. And we arrived at the moment of Van Persie's flying header. And that was like,
oh my God.
If someone had told little Kay Murray, 1990, watching Italia 90, oh, you're going to wait many a year, decades, in fact, to get to a World Cup yourself, but you're going to walk in on one of the really iconic moments in the middle of a stadium. You're a little bit late, but you'll catch this bit. But even walking in, it was everything I imagined, just an explosion of colour in the stadium, fans dancing, singing, an atmosphere like I'd never known before. Just so wonderful. So I think covering a World Cup as a broadcaster, and for it to be in Brazil as well, was just fabulous.
That's beautiful. Now, did your friend Pelé ask for a photo for you that time in Brazil?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. I was usually running around with, like, helping my camera. In Brazil, I was doing a role of, so I was assigned to follow Spain, the defending champion Spain, wherever they went. And so, you know, I expected a deep run. I didn't expect them to be out in the group stages. And although I should have, following the World Cup curse and how it I remember, though, they said, as soon as Spain are out, though, whenever that may be, you'll get posted back to Rio. So I thought, well, it wouldn't be the worst thing in the world to be quite sure. Anyway, the night they did, it was like completely confirmed. Chile were in the group, as you may or may not remember. I had a big bottle brought to the table of Chilean wine that night in Rio. Oh. As I got told, the rest of the World Cup will be spent here in Rio, and you will be in a studio, but you will be going out in the area, and you'll probably be sent to a few more games from other teams, reporting on some of the stories from around the country. And that was really, really quite something, because I got to just see Brazil for what it is, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and to bring those stories. I really wanted to bring the essence of Brazil as a World Cup hosting nation to the masses at home, and I hope that I was able to do that by bringing the good and the bad stories about it too.
I think that's what made that so beautiful, is that you need to, and that's you doing a hell of a job as a journalist, though, is that not everything can be as glossy, or I don't like to use the word propaganda, but sometimes a lot of these tournaments, these major, whether it's the Olympics or World Cup, tends to be like that. Qatar this year clearly exposed a lot of that leading up to it, especially. But for all intents and purposes, the tournament went off pretty well. But Brazil, there's such a dichotomy over there that it, as much as I want to believe that everyone's samba dancing in the streets all the time and snacking on the most delicious food for, like, really cheap, that's not the case. You know, it's more a City of God, that movie, than it is, you know, The Girl from Ipanema.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, even going, like, to some of the places that we visited where kids didn't have shoes, and people were telling us the real story, and we tried to tell people this. One of the really sad things was they said, thanks so much for giving the kids some of the stuff and giving the kids hugs. Yeah. They said, there's been some other journalists, they come, and for the cameras, they showed, you know, giving food out, but as soon as the kids were coming close to them, because the kids were dirty, and they didn't want that when it wasn't on camera. And the guy who'd taken us around was like, thanks for just being real people. And it was like, who's trying to, like, even exploit kids in this way? Like, trying to show, oh, aren't we great, giving them soda and candy, but please don't touch me. So there was, like, and you'd see, like, 2-year-old kids in some places playing out in the street late at night. And you're like, oh my goodness, this is so sad. This is so sad. And, you know, just going up to see Christ the Redeemer, that we did, like, it was one of the, like, bucket list thing, let's go up here and see this. And the guy who'd taken us around the areas that he had said, just to let you know that some of these kids, they'll see that from a distance. They've grown up here in Rio, and there's no way they'll ever even get up there. They wow. they can't get up there to even see that. And so it's just stuff that you're taking for granted that you think that everybody in Rio will have been there. It'll be part of their life. No, we saw a lot of the reality of how things were, how things in the favelas were. But one thing we did see, which is so beautiful, and it is true of pretty much all of Brazil, is how football is just unites everybody. And it's the one common language that everybody had, regardless of their background.
That's, there is even like really dark moments, there is beauty to be had. And if that is the slimmest of things, then that's a beautiful thing to remember. And I can't think of a better way to end all of this. So, Kay, thank you so very much for everything. Thank you so very much for coming on, being candid, being just incredible and being inspiring. And come back anytime. Love to have you.
Oh, I will. And if anyone is listening to this and wants to talk anything about IVF and the topics that I've touched on, please do reach out to me and I will do my best to help with some advice if that'll help anyone.
Oh, love it. I can promise you all, she's just as amazing off camera as she is on camera. So take her up on it. And thank you so much again.
My pleasure. Sounds my pleasure.
Follow us on Twitter at Curva Mundial Pod and subscribe to us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening.